Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, we preview the September 2024 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember that Retinal Physician can be found on print and online for free at retinalphysician.com. This issue focuses on a weak spot in my armamentarium. It's ocular oncology. You know, most of us don't see ocular oncology patients on a daily basis, but we often have to manage them. There are relatively few ocular oncologists in certain areas, and at least we need to know how to refer them and how to plug them in for care and understand what types of care they will receive. So this is a great episode and a great series of articles covering advancements and treatments for various tumors, including some benign tumors of the retina, retinoblastoma, primary vitreoretinal lymphoma, and uveal melanoma. And it was my pleasure to be joined by Drs. Maura De Nicola and Basil Williams for this episode. I learned a lot from them, and I hope you learn a lot as well. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with the preview of the September 2024 edition of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, you can find Retinal Physician online and in print at retinalphysician.com. This September 2024 edition focuses on ocular oncology. And as a retina specialist who encounters ocular oncology, like many of us do, but doesn't handle it primarily, I couldn't think of two better people to bring on to talk about this than two of my colleagues who are ocular oncologists. So going in alphabetical order, first, Dr. Maura De Nicola is an ocular oncologist, uveitis medical retina specialist at Bascom Palmer. Maura, welcome.
Hi, Jay. Thanks for having me.
And then Dr. Basil Williams is an ocular oncologist and vitreoretinal surgeon at Bascom Palmer.
Jay, great to be back. Thanks for having me.
So as always, we have got four articles. My goal is not to go through them in exhaustive detail. If you want to read the articles, they're available online for free. But I'm going to read through them, summarize, and ask you guys some questions about them. So the first article is called New Drug Therapies for Benign Retinal Tumors. mTOR inhibitors and HIF-2-alpha inhibitors have emerged as potential options. This is by Mary Aronow, who's now at Genentech, which I didn't know. Previously, I believe Hopkins before that, there was one stop in between.
Mass Eye and Ear.
Okay. So she wrote this article on retinal astrocytic hemangioblastoma and retinal capillary hemangioblastomas, which are benign tumors, but can have issues that can affect vision. We know as retina specialists, especially capillary hemangioblastomas are very famous for causing exudation. And it was interesting to think about whether or not there are systemic therapies that can treat these, whereas historically people have always used local therapy, whether that's laser, PDT, cryo, radiation, anti-VEGF. And so, just to quickly summarize, they talk about mTOR inhibitors for astrocytic hemangiomas and some of the basic science evidence. One of the things they do comment on is most astrocytic hemangiomas don't grow, but for the ones that do, it may be reasonable to use an mTOR inhibitor. Remember, this is systemic treatment, and so it's a little bit different than what we're normally used to in retina. And then the HIF-2-alpha inhibitors for retina capillary hemangioblastomas, which again, more famously give you more symptoms and can cause more issues. And it's interesting because it not only can treat the retinal manifestations, but they talk about it's also approved for VHL-related renal cell carcinoma, CNS hemangioblastoma, and pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor. So it's nice in a sense because you're not simply treating a retinal disease. A lot of times these patients, they have von Hippel-Lindau disease, will have multiple tumors throughout their body, and you can address all of these with a similar pathway. And again, they talk about most of this is not necessary maybe for a patient with isolated retinal disease because local therapy can be very, very effective. But this is oral therapy, and because it treats other parts of the body as well, it may be useful in some patients with systemic disease. And so in my mind, and Maura, I'll get you to comment first, just about, let's talk about retinal capillary hemangioblastoma. I mean, for me, I think a little bit, since you're a uveitis specialist, a little bit like the debate between systemic and local therapy for a uveitis patient. If a uveitis patient only has one eye involved, no systemic disease, no systemic markers, then it gets a lot easier to decide to use local treatment versus systemic treatment. But for uveitis patients, and again, this is my very simplistic retina understanding, uveitis patients with bilateral disease and systemic markers and systemic disease in other parts of the body, then of course you can use local treatment, but you're probably going to use systemic treatment anyway. And so then it may reduce the side effects of local treatment. And uveitis, we're talking about steroid-related cataract, ocular hypertension. Here, in terms of retinal capillary hemangioblastoma, you're talking about the side side effects of, you know, laser in terms of ablation, loss of tissue. So what are your thoughts on this? I mean, again, these are pretty, for a retina specialist in practice, you're not going to see a retinal capillary hemangioblastoma every day. These are not orphan diseases, but for the retina community, they're pretty rare. Just your thoughts on this and how they summarized what they can do. I mean, how often do you see a patient with von Hippel-Lindau syndrome? How common is it for an ocular oncologist?
Yeah, so I think your analogy is on point, Jay. There are a number of things you need to consider when you're trying to decide between local treatment versus systemic treatment for these patients. Now, to answer your last questions, they're not particularly common. We don't see a ton of these, and also depends on probably where you work, even as an ocular oncologist. For instance, if you have your university, your hospital as a center that treats a lot of VHL, then you're certainly going to see more. But in general, you know, the idea of using systemic treatment is definitely fascinating because we are not treating just the effects of the tumor, of the benign tumor, so the exudation necessarily, but we're going a little bit, you know, we're acting ahead in a way that we're acting on the mechanism that kind of drives this condition. So that's an interesting point. In terms of, deciding between local versus systemic, when you're putting these patients on systemic treatment, you have to consider a number of things. There are side effects from these medications. There is the potential, question on when do we stop this medication? What happens when we stop this medication? Do they tend to grow back? And then there are practical considerations specifically for belzutifan for capillary mandibulostomas, because these are only FDA approved over 18 years old and not for isolated retinal hemangioblastomas. So they are, you know, approved for other cancers. So if you do have a patient that has renal cell carcinoma or a CNS tumor, then certainly it makes sense because you're treating both conditions. But if it's isolated ocular, it might be a little bit harder to get this approved. The other thing is, in my opinion, when you have, you know, lesions that are small enough that you can target them with laser and treat them definitively, that's probably the way to go. Now, if you have larger tumors, you might want to use belzutifan to shrink it to the point that then you can do laser. But, you know, if you ablate these lesions, that's going to be definitive treatment. So my kind of, point of view is whenever I can do it, I'll do it. And other considerations are, again, based on systemic condition, involvement of the other eye, how many tumors are we treating? Obviously, if there's multiple tumors in both eyes, systemic treatment makes more sense as opposed to repeated local treatment. And a combination of both things often makes sense as well, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's super helpful. And Basil, just to turn our attention to retinal astrocytic hemartomas, again, like I said, our teaching is rarely that we have to treat these. It's usually in conjunction with tuberous sclerosis, the classic teaching. I didn't even know there were aggressive versions until I read this. It wasn't something that really occurred to me. So again, how often, they say it's pretty rare, how often is someone getting an aggressive sort of astrocytic hemartoma? And again, they described the case of a 13-month male, so fairly young patient, where they did try local therapy and then they had to go to systemic everolimus. Small numbers here again, and then it seems that it's not, I mean, it seems like it's not something that you'd see every day, but what are mTOR, just so like we have perspective as retina people, what would everolimus be used for besides tuberous sclerosis? Like how easy or difficult would it be to get a patient on this if you felt they needed it?
Yeah, so I think Maura has mentioned some good points. I think in both conditions, these medications were used to treat the more aggressive components of the systemic disease. So for VHL, as she mentioned, those the pheochromocytoma and the renal cell carcinoma. And then for tuberous sclerosis, for the SEGA lesions, the subependymal giant cell astrocytomas. And so when patients get seizures, you can treat those seizures with this medication. So I actually think that this medication is somewhat available, whether you use everolimus, and some people have used sirolimus in a similar class. These are quite rare. We will see patients with tuberous sclerosis. We will see patients with retinal astrocytic hamartomas. But to see aggressive ones that are causing exudation and leakage, that is quite a rare thing. I probably have seen two of these cases in my career. One patient was going to be started on everolimus for seizure disorder. So it actually worked out well because the localized astrocytomas were not responding well to local treatment. And so it actually stabilized disease and shrunk the tumors a little bit and did have a lasting response when we stopped the medication. But the challenge, you know, again, as Mauro mentioned, is we don't know how long people need to be on these medications. We don't know what's going to happen when we get them off medications, but it is really an exciting time to have new treatment options that were originally designed for the more aggressive components of these systemic conditions to now treat intraocular disease. So it's exciting and we have a lot more to learn, but definitely something that we keep in our back pockets and try to utilize when necessary, but definitely in collaboration with our pediatric oncologists and pediatric hematologists.
And transitioning now, the next article is about something a retina specialist may see more of or know more about, which is uveal melanoma. And it was a summary of current trials in uveal melanoma by Yehonatan Weinberger and Arun Singh from the Cleveland Clinic. And again, just a quick summary, they go through three trials relevant to uveal melanoma. They talk about the COMPASS trial, which is using a very cool mechanism, light activated viral recombinant particles to kill cancer cells. And again, why is it kind of lumped in with these trials? The whole idea is that you can avoid radiation retinopathy, which is the big complication they're talking about, if you don't use radiation in the first place or minimize radiation. And so this is suprachoroidal injection plus laser. And the trial that's ongoing is three arms, suprachoroidal injection plus a higher dose of bel-sar with laser, a lower dose with laser or sham with sham laser. And right now, this is a follow-up for, you know, essentially tumor progression, tumor thickness, growth rate, visual acuity failure at 1 year, and is ongoing. This is the COMPASS trial. Then you have protocol AL, which has been referenced before. It's is a DRCR protocol looking at radiation retinopathy, where patients are being randomized to faricimab, ILUVIEN, or observation. So using either a long-acting steroid, an anti-VEGF that's a little on the longer-acting durability side, or observing patients who have been treated with radiation with the brachytherapy plaque. And then they are being treated essentially to see what's the visual acuity gain, and then also do they get macular edema over time. And then the last trial that's ongoing is protocol IDE that they talked about, that is the darovasertib. It's hard for me to say, but it's a protein kinase C inhibitor. Which acts to show anti-tumoral effect and is in currently a phase two trial for primary uveal melanoma. So again, an alternative to radiation. And I think that all of this is sort of trying to go to the next step, Basil, which is avoid radiation in the first place, or if you do have it, treat from the beginning so you don't get radiation retinopathy. Because there are a lot of downsides to radiation, although of course it's globe sparing. Let's talk about AL, because I think this is the one that, again, DRCR is something that's very common for retina specialists to hear about. Do you know, in terms of the study design, I think it's interesting to think that they decided to use ILUVIEN versus a different steroid. It's a low-dose steroid, long-term maintenance. We use it for diabetic macular edema. It's FDA approved for 3 years of treatment. Any reasons it was picked for this versus a more potent, like a Triesence, Ozurdex, something like that, that would be bolus. Obviously, the disadvantage, you have to inject more often, but they do have a faricimab group, so those patients would be injected. Just from a study design standpoint, thinking as an ocular oncologist.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's obviously lots of complicated discussions behind the scenes in clinical trials of choosing the most appropriate medication. I think probably some of that has to do with getting access to the medication to use in the trial. So I don't really know the particulars behind that part, but I do know that with the dexamethasone implant and Ozurdex injection, you know, it's a larger gauge needle to be doing that kind of injection every 3 months. For a 3 year or a 2 year period, is a little bit different of a profile compared to an anti-VEGF or faricimab injection on an every 3 month basis. So I think there is a little bit of a difference there, and we don't know what's going to be the most effective option. It is interesting that ILUVIEN is kind of a lower strength or lower potency kind of steroid, and so I imagine similar to diabetes, there are going to be some cases of radiation retinopathy that may have a more aggressive inflammatory profile where ILUVIEN may not be sufficient. But that's something that remains to be seen. So I think this is really interesting, and this this is something, as you mentioned, that really relates to the retina specialist, because retina specialists are managing a lot of these patients with radiation retinopathy after they develop. And I think this is particularly interesting because it's not only about managing the condition after it happens, which is kind of a relentless thing. It's much more about trying to prevent or even delay the onset of radiation retinopathy. So patients are treated upfront to see if we can actually prevent the damage from happening. So quite an interesting time for retina specialists and ocular oncologists alike.
Yeah, and Mara, you can comment on the radiation retinopathy treatment. Again, this is probably the most relevant to retina specialists, thinking about ways to treat it. I thought also the rescue is interesting in this trial because you essentially can rescue both ways. So if you're on faricimab, it's not sufficient, you can rescue with Iluvien. If you're on Iluvien, it's not working, you rescue with faricimab, which is kind of cool. And it'll be interesting to see how that bears out, whether combo therapy ends up being better than one pathway alone. And then also, any thoughts on Compass versus, I'm not even going to try to say, our protein kinase C inhibitor, you know, from a pathway perspective, mechanism perspective, it's interesting to see suprachoroidal therapy enter the ocular oncology space because it's something that's entered the retina world now with Zyper and now also looking at RegenxBio, what they're doing, suprachoroidal gene therapy. I would imagine that one of the concerns that originally came with like intravitreal injections for cancers was, oh, are you going to cause seeding? Are you going to cause problems? And I think the learning point from RB, for example, was that, yeah, and I know it's controversial, but it seems to be that you can treat intravitreally without much risk of seeding. I would imagine that the community would feel similarly about suprachoroidal, given you're not even entering into the eye. But again, just your thoughts on this, and then where are we going to be in 5, 10, 15 years? Like, we went from these patients get enucleated and then maybe you can do some, you know, transpupillary therapy, right? Or external beam radiation. And then it became the era of plaques. And now it seems like it's evolving maybe that plaques may not be something that are done as frequently in 10 or 15 years. It's obviously difficult to coordinate with a radiation oncologist, get the dose ordered, get the beads ordered. This could be something that's much more accessible even to retina specialists in areas where they don't have ocular oncology or radiation oncology access. They may just have someone who says, hey, you can go ahead and give a suprachoroidal injection for this patient and remotely monitor with photos. So just your thoughts on where the field is going to go and which of these two you're more excited about. And you can also comment on radiation retinopathy as well.
Yeah. So I do think these are exciting times for ocular oncology. And while the, you know, kind of the idea behind both the Compass trial and the IDEA trials, it's similar, right? Trying to treat this cancers in a way that doesn't necessarily involve radiation, you know, the targets and even the way that we deliver this treatment is very different. So obviously with Compass, we are targeting much smaller lesions, so-called high risk indeterminate lesions or small choroidal melanomas. They have very, selective criteria in terms of the size of the tumor, the growth rate of the tumor, and so on and so forth. But, it is interesting to see how the suprachoroidal space is being explored and used more and more for multiple conditions across, you know, retina and oncology and uveitis. This was a trial that was in the first phase, the injection was given intravitrally, but there seemed to be some, inflammatory response to that way of administration of the viral particles. So suprachoroidal seems to make sense. You know, you're kind of avoiding that that reaction, at least theoretically that way, and then time will tell us. And then, of course, you know, you're injecting where the tumor is in the cord. So by going suprachoroidal, you are going close to the space where, you know, the tumor is. So that's exciting. We'll see how that turns out. But on the other hand, the IDEA trial targets a little bit of a different kind of problem, meaning those tumors that are so large that you would have to either enucleate these eyes or you would deliver such a high dose of radiation that the side effects would be very significant. And I find this extremely exciting because that's one of the hardest conversations that we as ocular oncologists face in clinic when we are, discussing, eye removal for some of these patients. So to be able to shrink it to the point that we can radiate it, or even to shrink it in a way that we can really decrease the radiation side effects and the really long journey that these patients have ahead of them in terms of managing the complications, to me, is very exciting. This requires, obviously, like a level of comfort in observing these patients for the first 6 months, while you're at least maximum 6 months while this trial is ongoing. But it is, to me, this is very exciting to be able to give patients this opportunity. And then to address your question about, you know, where the field is going, I will just say that in the past, when we had patients with metastatic uveal melanoma, unfortunately, the conversations that we had with our patients were very, very short. And the conversation was, there's nothing we can do about it. There's really nothing effective we can do for you, unfortunately. Now, these are very long conversations. And thankfully, we have, you know, allies in the medical oncology space that really help us navigate this. But I think it's going to be a similar, you know, situations for us as, you know, right now we are discussing eye removal versus radiation. I think our conversations in the future are going to be much longer with these patients because thankfully we're going to have more options to give them. So as we understand more about the pathogenesis and the molecular characteristics of this cancers, I think we're also able to target them more effectively.
Wonderful summary. And then just to tie it in, because I mentioned it, the next article, Arun Singh was also a co-author, Melly Prasad, will switch gears, just about intravitreal chemo for RB. It's a pretty short article, but I think the big take homes that I took from it is, first of all, intravitreal chemo for RB seems to be most useful in when there's vitreous seeding, because intravenous or intra-arterial chemo don't get the same penetration. And then the second thing is, it's still an adjuvant because it doesn't treat the primary tumor effectively on its own. It's used as an adjuvant in the setting of vitreous seeding. To talk about melphalan versus topotecan, of course, melphalan can give you toxicity with the salt and pepper retinopathy and with toxicity. And then the last thing they sort of talk about is a little bit of the technique that you can do and then the outcomes. And just, Mara, you can comment on this too as we circle back. Like, this, again, is a very controversial area that changed the field of RB. And so you talked about difficult conversations, how your conversation for RB used to be, in a way, maybe more easy, even though it's a hard conversation. You used to say, look, the eye needs to come out. And that's it. And, you know, maybe there's systemic chemo, maybe there isn't, depending on what else is going on. But now patients, of course, and patients are children, so their parents are the ones advocating for them. They want globe salvage therapy because there are descriptions of globe salvaging therapy. And it makes those conversations a lot harder and a lot longer, especially as parents have more and more information and more opinions. And I know there are divisions within the field about what patients are the best candidates for IAC versus when they should be enucleated. And these can be very difficult conversations to have, I know, because, of course, it's much easier in some ways for a parent to decide for their own eye than to decide for their child's eye, who's maybe not even at a verbal stage of their life. So, I mean, just the comments about the complexity of RB counseling, treatment, and how you sort of see each of these options fitting in. Obviously, it's a complicated question. It depends on the patient a lot. Every patient's different. But sort of your views on, like, where does IAC fit in relative to enucleation? In which cases do you say, how much time do you have, for example, to try globe salvaging therapy before you have to say, look, enucleation is indicated?
Yeah, so those are all excellent questions, Jay. So as you said, the conversation is always very complex with families of children diagnosed with retinoblastoma. And as you said, it's a very different decision. It's the level of complexity, you know, in terms of like eye removal for yourself as opposed to for your child, you know, it's very different. Certainly intra-arterial chemotherapy, intravitreal chemotherapy have been game changers. A lot of treatment failure in the past was related to vitreous seeding and refractory vitreous seeding. So having, you know, intravitreal chemotherapy available has hugely changed the prognosis and, you know, the globe salvage rates of these patients. Now, of course, you know, every patient does not like the idea of removing the eye from one of their children. And it's a kind of, you know, everybody, the inclination, I think, would be to try to salvage the eye if at all possible. However, there are considerations to make because certain group E, for instance, group EI is very advanced disease, you know, Globe salvage rate is very low in this scenario still, even with the treatments that we have available now. And you are kind of you know, this children, the burden in terms of coming back multiple times for multiple examination under anesthesia, having to undergo anesthesia many times, having to undergo chemotherapy in multiple forms several times, that all has, I think it plays a role in the decision making. And I feel like as ocular oncologists, our goal is, you know, we always have these conversations with our patients. Our number one goal is the life of the patient. The number two goal is to salvage their globe. And number three is to maximize vision, but they come in this order. So I think this is something that should be remembered. Now that being said, it, definitely to your point, the conversation is much more nuanced, but I think these are good, you know, kind of points to keep in mind when kind of tackling these conversations with patients.
Great points. And Basil, any comments on, again, that conversation? It's kind of a philosophical discussion, right? Because we obviously, as doctors, want more options for patients. It's okay if the conversation becomes more complicated, because that's generally a good thing. That means that all the things we're talking about are fairly extreme forms of care. You know, if you went to a ophthalmologist in ancient Greece and you had a cataract, they would tell you your options are couching or nothing, and you would have two binary choices. And now when you go to have cataract surgery, you have a million options to discuss. And so it's not necessarily a bad thing, but I think the hard thing to navigate again is sort of the education, the multiple opinions, the misinformation, and then the psychology of it is very challenging, as Mauro was just alluding to. Again, how do you sort of stratify? Because I mean, you and I have had this conversation offline, even with trials that are ongoing, even with other options that are ongoing. And then there's a time component to it, right? Because you are still dealing with an active tumor. It may not be a tumor that's not like a MacOn RD that the next day, if you don't decide on the right treatment, maybe there's permanent vision loss. But you know, there is sort of a time component. No doctor, no human can exactly tell you the time at which it becomes too late to intervene, for example. It's all sort of ballpark numbers based on evidence about how long you could wait, for example. I can't imagine if I was a parent, I am a parent, and like if our daughter had an issue, I mean, what sort of timeline you have to operate under before you make the best decision for your child. So any comments on RB counseling on top of what Mara said?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think Mauro did did a wonderful job kind of characterizing the conversation and discussion. I think one of the big challenges is that we don't have the correct answer. And I think one of the new technologies coming out, or that's been in studies for a while, with Jess Berry's team and for aqueous humor and Jasmine Francis and Dave Abramson, looking at blood for liquid biopsy, is hopefully we're actually able to get a little bit inf more information specifically about the tumor, get an understanding of how prognosis is going to be. It's in the very early stages of that, but I think hopefully that technology will help, because right now it's based on physician experience, what the center normally does, the family's thought processes, and a few other factors. And I don't think we have the correct answer in all of these situations. So we try and go with the best information we have, how advanced the disease is, whether or not it's bilateral, if there's concern for extraocular extension, how close the disease is to the nerve, how much the treatment burden is on the family, the siblings, and those kind of things. So I think it's an individualized decision, and different families will approach it differently, which I think is okay. And hopefully we will be learning a lot more as liquid biopsy goes from the research stages into the clinical practice stages.
Wonderful. And just to wrap up, because this is again a great RP. If you have want an update on just where treatment is for multiple tumors, it goes through different ones. So the last article is about choosing treatment for PVRL or primary vitreoretinal lymphoma, which again some people used to call this what was it, primary intraocular lymphoma, PIOL. And I think the terminology has shifted a little bit over time. We all remember from our boards, they talk about this in this article by Elaine Binkley and Farzad Jamshidi. We all remember, like, there's a CNS lymphoma association that sometimes you may need to do vitrectomy, and there's sort of rules about how you do these sample selections to make sure you don't damage. How do you analyze these to see? Because it can be a very difficult diagnosis to make. But then getting into treatment, right? There's intravitreal chemo options, methotrexate, very famously. There's also radiation options. And then it's just the systemic therapy, right? And one of the things they do talk about, which is, again, not atypical for vitreous seeding, we talked about it. It's the same true for a lot of vitreous diseases, even endophthalmitis. You don't get great penetration of every drug into the vitreous from systemic drug. But they do mention there is some local penetration of methotrexate. So there may be an option to do systemic chemo, especially if they already have CNS disease. And this goes back to the exact same kind of common sense thing we were talking about earlier. You're treating multiple parts of the body, then maybe you do lean more on systemic treatment versus just local treatment. Just any quick hitting notes, Basil, on PVRL? I think they did a good job of summarizing. And just, I guess, the most relevant, and they talked about this to clinicians out there, is if you suspect PVRL, you don't have great access to get someone into ocular oncology, you want to establish a diagnosis, any sort of big hitting tips you would say, hey, I'm going to go do surgery, how to prepare, what to ask for, what are you sending out, that sort of thing?
Yeah, for sure. So first, I'll take a step back. When we think about intraocular lymphoma in general, there are two major categories. One is uveal lymphoma, and that tends to be a more benign, indolent process, tends to be extra marginal, like a MALT lymphoma, versus vitreoretinal lymphoma, involves the vitreous, subretinal, sub-RPE space, sometimes the optic nerve, and that tends to be a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And that distinction is really important because diffuse large B-cell is a much more aggressive tumor. It does go to the brain, perhaps 90% of the time, 80 to 90% of the time, and that tends to be what affects mortality. And so when we think about this condition and the propensity to go to the brain, this is how we kind of think about treatments. And I think if you go to, again, any center, they're going to have different opinions on this. I think a lot of people, when you see unilateral disease for vitreoretinal lymphoma, you will be thinking perhaps more about local treatment, whether that be intravitreal chemotherapy or radiation. There are considerations with each. With intravitreal, it requires the patient to come back frequently. There's variations in the algorithm for what you should do. Radiation, perhaps in the long run, has less frequency in treatments, but there's concern about the radiation effects to the brain. And if you end up getting brain disease later on, how many times can radiation affect the brain before it starts causing long-term damage? So I think there are considerations there. A lot of centers, regardless of whether or not there's CNS involvement, if there's bilateral disease, and even some centers, if there's unilateral disease, believe that because CNS involvement happens so often, this is likely a spectrum of disease, and perhaps doing systemic treatment upfront in addition to local will have some benefit. None of the studies have really borne out that systemic chemotherapy reduces the development of CNS disease, but that is a thought. It is quite an aggressive treatment to do systemic chemotherapy with high dose methotrexate and then autologous stem cell transplant afterwards, but it is something that we're still trying to figure out as a community. So I think, again, similar to retinoblastoma, a lot of the treatment choices are based on what center you're in and how you're managing these patients. So, and then the last thing, I think from the biopsy perspective, there's a couple of things to keep in mind. This diagnosis is often come to after uveitis has been ruled out, which means the patient may or may not have been on steroids for some time. Because steroids can decrease your diagnostic yield, it's nice to get the patient off of steroids for a couple of weeks before you proceed with diagnostic vitrectomy. The critical point is to reach out to your pathologist or cytopathologist to understand what they need. How they would like your sample sent, and then to determine whether and how you're going to split it between cytology, which is by far the most important, and then other ancillary tests like flow cytometry, interleukin, MyD88, looking for gene rearrangement and various other things. So doing the vitrectomy, I think the article did a great job. Historically, we would decrease the cut rate to try and reduce how much the cells are sheared, but we're not sure how much of a difference that makes. We usually start off in a non-dilute sample. So on fake patients, you can just keep the infusion off. On pseudophakic patients, some people like to run air in, so that way the eye maintains a stabilization while you get more of the vitreous. So there's a number of ways that this can be approached, but I think the key things are making sure the patients are off of steroids and then communicating with the pathologist beforehand so the samples can be sent appropriately and can be sent as quickly as possible. This is not one of those Friday afternoon, Friday evening cases that you want to be doing. You want to have it scheduled appropriately.
Those are great tips. And I really like everything you said. You know, one thing, Mara, from a treatment perspective, that's interesting. He talked a little bit about like this, maybe the idea if you initiate systemic therapy, it prevents systemic complication like CNS disease later. It's interesting because it made me think a little bit of like stuff from like the ONTT or like optoneuritis when you're reading your books. It's like, oh, if you have this patient and you put them on IV steroids, you may decrease, right, their risk of MS symptoms later. And it was one of those things we always read in residency and we're like, that doesn't really make that much sense, but maybe you are doing something. Maybe you're interrupting some sort of inflammatory cascade that later goes downhill. Anything to add from like a treatment perspective to what Basil was saying? Anything else? Any other notes on PVRL before we break?
No, I think Basil did a fantastic job kind of summarizing how we think through this. Again, this are very, tailored, personalized conversations. Different patients are going to have kind of different needs. Some of the initially described protocols for intravitreal chemotherapy they're very intense. They involve 25 injections in a year. So obviously that's a lot. And especially for patients that are systemically sick, that might be a lot. So all of these things need to be kind of discussed. Potentially the treatment protocol can be adjusted. I guess the one thing I would add is just to keep in mind, that methotrexate can have some corneal toxicity. So you want to make sure you don't get reflux when you are injecting. So appropriately lower the pressure, whether you achieve that with an AC tap as opposed to applying pressure to the globe prior to injecting. The article actually mentions something that Dr. Elaine Binkley, who is the one of the authors of this article, does, which is having a higher concentration of the medication. So she's able to deliver 400 micrograms in 0.05 ml. So if your pharmacy can compound that, that's actually fantastic because you're injecting a smaller volume in the eye and that can kind of improve your side effect profile.
Great. Really wonderful to have you both talking about these articles and giving us perspective as retina specialists who are not ocular oncologists. So we really appreciate your wisdom. Amar De Nicola, Basil Williams, thanks so much for joining the program.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks again to Drs. Amar De Nicola and Basil Williams for joining us for this episode. Listeners, you can find all 441 of our episodes on our website at retinapodcast.com. That's right. All the way back to episode 1 in November 2016, they're all archived and available for your listening pleasure. If you ever have questions or any feedback, comments on what we can do better, or episode ideas for the future, you can email me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. As we move into September, I hope everyone had a great Labor Day weekend, got some good R&R with family if you weren't on call. Thanks again for taking care of patients. Thanks again for all you do. Residents and fellows out there, especially those first-year fellows or first-year residents, can't believe you're already 2 months in. Keep your chin up. Keep working hard. Keep reading. Keep learning. If you're listening to this, doing what you can to stay involved in the field and learn more of the lingo, especially for those PGY1 and 2 residents. And again, anyone who ever has any questions or issues can always reach out to me directly. I'm happy always to collaborate and help. Thanks again to our whole production team, Justin Ma, Louis Kai, Mike Nakasa, Angela Chang. 3 attendings now and 1 resident, soon to be a fellow. So our team has grown up as the podcast has grown up. Thanks to all of them for the dedication they've shown the podcast over the years. And again, listeners, thank you for all you do. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.